Blog Talk Radio. Good evening, everybody, and welcome once again to Madam Perry's Salon, the podcast that loves you, the podcast that brings you the most fascinating people. We're a cultural salon in cyberspace, or as one of my first guests, Robert Leland Taylor, after he was on, he went back and announced to the Facebook world, he said, "I've been to Madam Perry's Salon, and it looks like the inside of Jeannie's bottle." So we're here out in the Jeannie bottle. I'm having my my fantasy of having my own cultural salon right here on a podcast in a Jeannie bottle in outer space. And I am thrilled to have you here. Again, I'm Madam Perry. If you're here for the first time, I am also not just the host and producer. I am your spiritual advisor, groove mistress, and cruise director for the evening. But you don't have to call me Madam. You can call me Jennifer, Jan. Musicians usually call me JP. You can call me Perry. I don't care. I'm just happy that you're here and just so thankful that we're going into this show for I don't know how many years now, but I will say this. Some of the most recent guests, Dave Koz, Grammy-winning saxophonist Dave Koz that was on here a couple of months ago. You know, he's out on tour now, and he's checking in with me, and I'm saying, you know, these are the shows, these are the pictures, and I'm going, that's great. Hopefully when you get to Atlanta, I can go. So thrilled to have him. He's a sweetheart of a guy. Also, Zuzu from the band Soraya Rocks was here recently, and they're out on tour. They're in the States now. They'll be in Sweden very soon. And for all of these people, I'll always share their social media information on all of mine as Madam Perry, as well as my personal social media so that you can find them. Franny Goldie has been posting lately about a big sale on her website. Now, Franny Goldie, you know, she was on here. She's a songwriter, wrote some of the biggest hits in the world. Night Shift by the Commodores, Stick With You, Pussycat Dolls, Dreaming by Selena. And she has a clothing store. Her magic pants are always in Oprah and on The View. And, you know, if you go to her website and you go to buy something, and put in MPS, the initials of Madam Perry Salon. When you go to about use that for your code, you'll get a discount. So she wants to make sure everybody knows that. What else? Oh, Tina McElroy Ansa was on maybe about a month and a half ago. And my friend Kenya Colbert, who most of you that are regular listeners, you know my number one BFF, Kenya Colbert. Kenya co-hosted that show. And while we were talking, Tina's friend Wanda Lloyd, also a writer, called in, and we chatted for a while. Well, since then, we all had so much fun. In fact, if he's listening now, and he probably is, science fiction author Z.Z. Claiborne, who his latest book, when he was on here, was his latest sci-fi book is Afro Puffs Are the Antenna of the Universe. But this is an adult science fiction book. Don't make the mistake I did to buy for my grandchildren and then it was. I read it just before I did that, mind you. But anyway, Z.Z. Claiborne listened to us and said, it was like listening to a bunch of my aunts when they're playing cards when I was a kid. And I thought, well, that sounds like a good thing. But anyway, they now have, Wanda and Tina have a podcast, and it's called Two Old Chicks Who Know a Lot of Shit. So find it on YouTube or Spotify or somewhere. They are so much fun, and they do know a lot of stuff, and a very smart and great writer. So tonight's guest, I am so super psyched because this is going to I have been waiting for this night. Tonight's guest is an author. This is her debut novel, and my gosh, if this is how she's starting out, if this is a debut novel, we've got a lot to look forward to from her. Her book is called A Conspiracy of Mothers. It's the story of three mothers whose lives intersect during a generation-defining period in South Africa's history of apartheid. The book has been compared. Well, the author Susan Bernard actually said, A Conspiracy of Mothers is a brilliant novel to be read alongside Trevor Noah's Born a Crime and Isabel Wilkerson's Castle. So before I just keep going on, I am want to introduce here for the first time, and from the conversation I've already had with her, hopefully not the last time at all, welcome to Madame Perry's Salon, Colleen Van Niekerk.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on and to chat with you.
It's an absolute delight for me. Did I pronounce your name correctly? I should have asked that before.
Oh, yeah. No, you've got it. There are two ways to say my last name. Van Niekerk is probably the best in North America, but in South Africa, you would say Van Niekerk. So Van Niekerk is a little bit easier.
Okay. Well, from my accent, you probably thought I was in New York or something, right? So.
No. Definitely not. Regionally, no.
No, okay. All right, well, as long as I'm not too far off. Thank you. I'm so glad you're here, and thank you for getting me into your schedule and with your publicist as well. Congratulations on your book and on the great reviews you're getting. And
thank you.
Is this true? This is your debut novel?
It is. I mean, you know, I think, you know, as with any sort of any writer, it takes a long time to get any piece of work out. So it feels like it's taken forever, but, you know, it is the first.
Okay.
Certainly of many, but the first.
Yeah, because you've got a lot going on here in different places and history and so forth, a lot of things to put in. And to also, it's the kind of book to where if you're not familiar, like most of us aren't, with, you know, they always say Americans don't know what's going on outside of America. But if you don't know, you know, there's a lot of history, too, for South Africa. Now, my husband has worked a lot in Africa, and he would go for sometimes 2 to 3 to 4 months at a time, mostly working on West Africa, like Guinea-Bissau, you know, Conakry, you know, on the Ivory Coast, sometimes in Central Africa, North or Central Africa. Once he went to South Africa, and he found it to be a very uncomfortable place. So,
interesting.
Yeah. So
when was that exactly, if you don't mind me asking?
It may have been, I'm trying to think. It may have been in the 90s.
Okay.
In the mid-90s. Yeah. But we'll get to that later. So if we do. But anyway, yeah. Yeah, I think the only good thing was he said they had to stayed in these little cabins, but they were, I guess, bamboo huts. And he said the doors didn't lock, but every night a German shepherd would come in and stay with them and sleep all night and then go back out the next morning, same German shepherd. So, and since we had one at home at the time, he said, okay, I just felt like he was sending me a buddy. Anyway, so talk about the description. Now, I just gave a quick description, but Conspiracy of Mothers. And when you mentioned, when it said here, Trevor Noah's Born a Crime or Isabel Wilson's Cast. I haven't read Cast. I think I mispronounced it earlier. Mm-hmm. I haven't read Cast, but I have read Trevor Noah's Born a Crime. And this is a situation that's also in the book, somebody whose actual birth
That's exactly it. I mean, Trevor's book was great. You know, I mean, Trevor's great. So, but it was a really entertaining read. But it's the same sort of set of laws that came into play. You know, really, I guess around his family situation that apply here as well. And it kind of goes back to, you know, to the set of laws that we had under apartheid that determined, you know, who could be intimate with whom, you know, how that worked. And the main sort of issue was really around, you know, there was a legally defined white race, legally defined other groups as well. So ensuring that there was no, you know, no intimate relations between the white race and any other race. So, you know, if you were, you know, it's always hard for folks outside of South Africa to understand this, but there are these different groups, you know, there's a mixed group, there's a black group, there's, you know, Indian, all these weird sort of subcategories that we had. So, you know, white people and any other people could not be intimately involved without the law sort of becoming a factor in their lives. So that, you know, that kind of, is the basis of what, you know, the sort of underlying conspiracy that sits really at the heart of the story.
Mm-hmm. So tell us more then about, tell us about the book, about the characters in it. Right. Yolanda, Rachel, Ingrid,
mm-hmm.
So who they are in their relationship.
Sure. So, you know, as you mentioned earlier, there are three mothers here, and I'll kind of touch on each of them. The protagonist who we, you know, whose story this ultimately is Yolanda. And she, you know, she is the mother of Ingrid. And Ingrid is really, you know, not to give too much away, but she is, you know, she is the crime here, to put it in quotes, in terms of someone born out of contravention of those laws. So when we meet her, she had been outside of South Africa for about 20 years. In self-imposed exile, she's in the States, and you know, and she had left in the 70s. You know, this is 1994 where we sort of meet her, and it's April of 94, sort of early in that month, just before these huge democratic elections in South Africa, and she's kind of weighing up whether or not to return, whether to go back. And many South Africans who were in exile, you know, politically imposed exile or self-imposed or whatever the situation was, did come back, you know, from the early 1992 onward, and she's sort of in that place where, you know, she has to return. You know, there are things that she has to face. You know, she had a particularly horrific incident happen to her. The return to the country means dealing with that. But you know, arguably bigger than that is the daughter that she had left behind, who is Ingrid, who she hasn't seen, you know, since she was a newborn. Which, you know, as you can imagine, that there's a lot of emotion attached to that. So Ingrid had been left in the care of the second mother, being Rachel, who is Yolanda's mother. So Ingrid had been living with her grandmother. And her grandmother, as well, you know, takes on a sort of protecting sort of role within the story. She wants Yolanda to find peace, to return, to find home, to find peace. She wants Ingrid to understand her origins, and she kind of orchestrates things to kind of bring that to fruition, and, you know, is a key driver in the story. But she, in turn, is also trying to find her own, you know, her own home, her own peace, her own sort of state of rest, as it were. So she's mother number two. And then the third one is actually Ingrid's other grandmother. So her father's white, and the father's mother, Elsa, you know, is sort of on the, you know, an antagonist here. So she's, you know, less keen to see the truth emerge, that this child exists, that a son had this relationship. So she becomes the kind of counterpoint to the other two mothers, to kind of pull in a different direction and kind of maintain the sort of conspiracy or secret here for as long as she can.
So that is, she hasn't seen her daughter, and since she was a baby, since she was born. So Yolanda, and because Ingrid's father was a white man, that makes it illegal. It was an affair.
Yep.
Right? Okay, so this is illegal.
Yeah.
And in the...
They were both... Sorry, go ahead.
No, honey. We're here to listen to you.
They were both young at the time. No worries. Uh-huh. They were young at the time. So, you know, it was a relationship that in any other circumstances, they would have just been two young people, you know, meeting and getting together, which, you know, obviously happens all the time. But, you know, at the time that it happened, you know, that obviously was probably problematic for both of them, but probably more so really for her, because, you know, in those circumstances at that time, where there was a sort of cross-racial, interracial relationship, it was almost always the person of color who got the more punitive end of the stick than the person who was white. But the white person, you know, there was a lot more blaming and shaming and naming happening there. And it was sort of treated as a moral, you know, moral and religious sort of issue. So problems all around of a different nature for both of those. So that's sort of, you know, Ingrid's origin story, as it were, in the context of her parents.
So then Yolanda goes, she leaves South Africa and goes to, where does she go, to England first?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, she has no clear exit plan when she goes. And the conditions, and that's partly because the conditions in which she's leaving are so challenging for her that she just knows that she needs to go. but she doesn't know, you know, where she's going. So there's obviously a lot of sort of, you know, personal stuff happening, but the bigger context, you know, within South Africa at the time was, you know, this is around 1976. And, you know, South Africa sort of went through, you know, periods of what was called unrest. And that moment was pivotal. It was, you know, an event called the Soweto Uprising happened. And it just generated a whole generation, sort of politicized a whole generation of people. And it just, you know, the upheaval kind of reached a boiling point and kind of, you know, really carried on from there into the 80s, if you look at history. But, you know, it created for her a clear sense that she could not be safe and she could not keep her child safe. So that, you know, so for her, the act of safety meant leaving and just going somewhere else. And England was the first sort of landing place for her. And then she kind of moved on from there many years later to the States.
Tell us part of what, a couple of the things that drive the story have to do, you know, with actual historical events, like the South Africa's National Party when they came to power and the legislation. Yeah. There was a couple of things, the Prohibition of Mixed Marriages Act, that was 49, and then right after that in 50, the Immorality Amendment Act. What were those? Mm-hmm. What did they mean to people, for those of us that, you know, for people that don't know?
Sure. So, you know, so they really, in summary, were two acts that, and it was interesting because the National Party kind of, almost as soon as they came into power, these were the acts that they focused on first, which kind of gives you a sense of what their priorities were. So they were, you know, if you look at apartheid overall, there was sort of grand apartheid, which was the, you know, major laws that really kind of, you know, racial classification and all these things that operated to kind of really establish segregation. And there was sort of, you know, petty apartheid, which was, you know, signs on the beach and fines and all these sort of things that kind of came up later. But this was the first sort of pair of acts. And, you know, this was the law. So, you know, legislation kind of came in. So there was a different act in the books earlier in the 20th century around, you know, kind of sort of forbidding, you know, cross interracial relations, but they formalized it with these two acts. And they, you know, if you look at the language of it, they make it very clear, but it's around, you know, there will be, you know, no intimate relations, no marriage. You know, they kind of really enshrined a sort of master-servant relationship between, you know, the white race and everyone else. And that was it. And, you know, there was, you know, penalty of fining, jailing, all these things could happen if you were found to break the law. And I think it's important to know people always find their way around these things, but, you know, you run the risk of getting caught, and that, that, you know, that can be bad.
You know, an interesting thing that in the author's note, the beginning of the book or before the book begins, and that I learned in Trevor Noah's book, is that how that government there had decided to categorize people.
Yeah.
That was the most, I know it's real and I know it's horrible, but it's just bizarre. Mm-hmm. Like, who's going to pick out who's going to be white, who's going to be black, who's going to be colored? Mm-hmm. I mean, have I got that right?
Yeah, you got that. I mean, the group I don't mention, Indian, but that, you know, there's a huge Indian presence in South Africa as well. But yeah, that's exactly it.
And so they just go ahead and put people in a group. And I've got to think, that's got to tear families apart too, as well as communities.
Yeah, very much so. Because I think people need to, you know, there was always some sense of separation, you know, and it's a long history. There's the English and there's the Afrikaners and they didn't get on. And, you know, there's all these different groups. There's a huge, you know, South Africa has 11 official languages. So, and that's because there are so many different groups as well, you know, other tribal groups that had been there before colonization. So they're in the mix as well. But, you know, so all of this existed. And then this, you know, this grand apartheid came and landed like a spaceship on top of all these people and said, you know, you guys are now black, you know, with completely sort of obliterating all the distinctions that exist within the different groups that fall in this sort of black banner. And you guys are white and colored. And the whole process of reaching that was classification. And as I said in the note as well, you know, they would test you, they would check your hair, they'd run a pencil, you know, the infamous pencil test is what people know. They put a pencil in your hair. If it fell out, if it stayed in, that determined the texture of your hair. I mean, just hugely, deeply humiliating things. Yeah, they check your nose, you know, the color of your eyes. And, you know, like the biologically, this is just, I mean, it's absurd because anyone will tell you that the, you know, the factors that go into determining those things are like point something of the makeup of people. So it's, but that's what they're fixated on. And you would go and be classified. It was in your ID book. You know, you'd have a little number into, you know, in this long number that said, this is who you are. And that's it. That's where you live. That's where you go to school. You know, the jobs you can have, all those things. Were determined by that. It's crazy.
It is. It's unfathomable. But as you put, when you were describing it in the author's note, you said about the outline of the different groups that people were assigned to, that after all, and this is a quote from your author's note, after all, one couldn't enact policies of white supremacy if one couldn't determine definitively who was white and who was not.
Exactly. It's a very chilling, very sort of calculating way of looking at it. But that's it. If you're going to give privilege to someone, then you need to say who that someone is. Mm-hmm. And they did it, you know, with just a very surgical sort of approach.
So let's get back. So now we've got some background on the story and origins and a little bit of background on you. So then tell us how this story came together, the characters of Yolanda, Rachel, Ingrid, and the other grandmother, Alsa. Alsa. How did those characters come together? Were they, you know, people always say, were they based on someone you know, or is that a composite?
Right. Yeah, they certainly are, you know, there are elements of things that I've seen in those two that kind of lend some veracity to them. I always say that, you know, writers try and walk this line between what's, you know, plausibility and veracity. Like, we kind of play in that space in the middle. So there definitely is that. I mean, none of them are based on, you know, on any particular person. There are experiences, you know, including my own, that are woven into some of them. You know, Yolanda, I think, was, you know, I sort of imagined her because, you know, I sort of imagined if I'd been born 15 years earlier, what are some of the things that I would have had to sort of consider? Just kind of looking back at the generation, that generation of 76 that came before, you know, who were they? What were some of the things that they dealt with? And, you know, and if you lived kind of as an artist outside of the political kind of sphere, you know, how do you process what's going on around you, and how do you kind of, you know, maintain your truth, especially as a woman and as a woman of color? Which, you know, in any situation is challenging, but I think particularly at that time was quite difficult. So for me, you know, that was, you know, I tried to sort of deal with some of those questions with her. With Rachel, there's a very strong, you know, again, desire on my part to really understand, you know, South Africa's own First Nations, the people who were there previously, who, you know, for us when we were growing up, were always kind of, you know, just sort of, you know, written out of the story. They were, you know, it was the sort of terra nullius, you know, people came and white people arrived and, you know, there was no one there except very grateful natives, and that obviously wasn't the case. So I wanted to sort of understand more about her, you know, her history and imagine what that was like. So that, you know, that was interesting and, you know, research what was possible. And then, you know, Ingrid's very much, you know, Ingrid's experiences are probably more sort of coterminous of my own. So, you know, I came of age in the 90s, so it was kind of easier to kind of imagine some of where she was at. But that transition period, you know, there was nothing about that predicted that it was going to be smooth. I mean, the country was, you know, was an enormously tumultuous time. You know, there was some indications before that, you know, there was going to be a loosening, and there was some loosening of laws. But it was, you know, it was challenging, and it still is in many respects. And then Alsa was probably the easiest to imagine because, you know, there's just this, you know, and, you know, readers who are familiar with that kind of very, you know, this is by the book kind of person. This is exactly how it is. This is the way I've set up my world. You know, that's, you know, that kind of obstinance is very much encompassed in her.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to write Conspiracy of Mothers? Because there's a lot. There's a lot of research that went into it, right?
Yeah, there is. There is, and you know, it was. I sort of, you know, it sounds odd, but I learned how to write by writing it. I sort of set myself this challenge. So it was a decade. you know, was all, okay, if you're going to, you know, either get on with this thing or just go do something else. So it was very much a case of, okay, so just make it happen. It was a decade, and it was a case of learning the craft of writing, you know, let alone getting into publishing, understanding, you know, that end of things. But yeah, there was a lot of research, because I had just left South Africa in, you know, when I sort of really took this on, and it was really an opportunity for me to look back and better understand, you know, okay, so, you know, when you live somewhere, there are things that you just don't see, because that's just a part of the fabric of what's around you. So it was a chance to really look and understand some of what I had taken for granted. So yeah, there was a lot of reading, research, understanding what, you know, okay, so we call ourselves, you know, these different names as groups. Why do we do that? You know, and figuring out then how to also explain that to others who may not, you know, may not understand where the terminology comes from. But yeah, it was a good few years.
Well, I tell you what, I'm fascinated by what you just said too about you learned to write. You feel like you learned to write by writing a book.
Yeah.
Lady. Okay. Well,
it's okay.
I think if that was a course, you taught yourself, I think you got the A+ summa cum laude on that, okay?
Thanks so much.
That's just such a magnificent job. I got to say, I know you're not going to have any spoilers for people, which is good, because I haven't finished it, because this is one of those books where I would start and have to go back over and read and go back over to make sure I had everything down. And then I'd find my husband reading over my shoulder, so I got to stop and let him finish that page. So, which is a good, so, you know, that's a good book.
Yeah. Also, good discussion. That will make for some good, you know, good chat about what do you think. So,
I wouldn't know he was there. You'd go, oh, that was all. And, well, I'm not going to say, because I don't want anybody to know. They got to figure it out for themselves. They got to read it themselves.
Right.
But then he would start commenting. I didn't know you were back there behind me reading. So, yeah, he would have a comment on something going on. And, okay, well, all right, let me just sit here and let you finish that page before I go on.
Oh,
you know,
great.
But that's good, because we both love to read. So,
right.
So yeah. So don't think this is the one, because it's got mothers about mothers. Do not think that this is strictly a women's book. This is not chick lit. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Well, my chick lit writer friends and fans, but that does not mean that this is just a woman's book by any means. When was the book actually published? It's just published this month.
It's actually so the official publication date is October the 1st. It was an Amazon first read pick for the September for now. So the Kindle edition is out. If you're a Prime member, it's out there. So that's, you know, so there's obviously that benefit. But the official date for all the other editions is October 1st.
Okay. Let me read. So you can get in on this now, write on it, put this on your TBR to be read list. I'd like to read part of the other, part of the review from Patrick Tariq Mellett, who is the author of The Lie of 1652, A Decolonized History of Land. And it says, quote, reading Colleen Van Niekerk's A Conspiracy of Mothers was a gut-wrenching, emotional roller coaster experience, with many lines resonating with my own belief that for South Africans to attain restorative justice, we first need to experience restorative memory. Colleen captures all of this so well in cameos of Captured Time, which closely touched many a raw nerve of yet unhealed wounds that are a part of many of our lives. The world of lies and secrets and the pain that goes with it are vividly brought to life. And that's deep. That means, you know, you had to go through and remember and relive a lot of things at the same time,
mm-hmm.
which I would think would be very difficult.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think it's also, you know, and you know, I can't say enough about Tariq. I've known him for a long time. You know, his own work and his own life, I think, are testament to a kind of resilience and a commitment, I think, to, you know, setting South Africa on the right course. So, you know, so that, but it's hard work, you know, it's always hard work. But I think, you know, I think looking at, you know, experiences that I've had and looking at, you know, as I mentioned again, when you're kind of in something, you don't think about, you know, all the implications of why things are the way, but understanding for my family, for others, you know, what are some of the sacrifices that people sort of went through and what are the things that people just lived with? Because I think that was a large part of why, so, you know, why apartheid proceeded as it did, because people just, you know, had that, well, this is the way it is, you know, kind of approach, which is, you know, it's shattering. There are things that you're still enabling a system by saying that, but you know, you don't see yourself as culpable in that way. So there were certainly things to contend with, you know, generationally, and I think that's the important part, really, of any experience of systemic racism. It is always generational. It's your experience. It's your, you know, your elders, you know, those who came before, those who are around you. And others who, you know, whose paths you sort of cross, just having that awareness of the context that we're all sort of living in.
Okay, I'm going to stop for just a moment. I'm going to get some more water. Maybe you can too. And for anyone listening, if you want to talk to Colleen, the number is 646-716-9922. It's a toll-free call in the continental U.S., 646-716-9922. Or for people who, I've got a lot of listeners that can't always call because they're on a job where they can't make a call like this. So they always send them messages. So you can always message me on Facebook either through Madame Perry Salon or through Jennifer Maudette Perry. And I will share your comment or question with Colleen. And let me get on the studio, and so you can send your question, your message, and I've got to tell you too, if you don't get a call, I got to tell you something about, I've been doing this show a long time, Colleen, and my listeners, very, very interesting people, oftentimes, they've never heard of the guest, they'll go get the information before the show, so they know some often more than I do about the guest by the time it happens. And sometimes they'll just listen. Nobody will call, and then afterwards I get lots of messages going, well, why didn't you ask them this? Well, I thought you were going to talk about that. And I go, you should have called. No, I was listening. So I've been able to come in right after. So I am very, very fortunate. I have a very savvy and intellectually curious audience. I've been very, very lucky like that.
That's great.
Okay, so here we go. Oh, don't want to play the wrong thing. All right, we'll be back in just almost a minute.
I mean, the world has gone crazy, right? I mean, this whole pandemic, I don't even know if I'm coming or going anymore. You know what I mean? But the one thing during the pandemic that I found out, right, that was a good thing was the Madame Perry Salon. I mean, this podcast, right? When you hear her laughing, all you want to do is laugh. Right? When her dog's barking in the background and she's talking to the duck, I'm like, she's going to an interview, and I'm like, this podcast is the best podcast I've ever heard before. You know what I mean?
See, you pay somebody enough money, they'll say anything for you. And let me tell you, we're lucky if these little extortionists that I call corgis don't start barking. Usually they sit there with a treat. Oh, nice pot. Oh, nice guest you have on tonight. Be a shame if something were to happen. They couldn't hear because we're barking. You know, because you got to have a fistful of milk bones to hand out. But anyway, that's enough of that.
Oh, goodness.
Okay. Yeah. And I asked the question about the difficulty of revisiting situations, and even though you're writing up characters, you're writing about real things that have happened to lots and lots and lots of people, and some things that you've experienced and things that you've seen friends and family go through. And I know that recently I was taking a comedy writing class. From a woman who's done written for a lot of TV and films and done a lot of stage work. And in the second one, she challenged me about something I had, something where I had titled one piece of work, because we all brought what we were working on for help. And she challenged me about something and said, why are you using this word? And I told her why. And she said, in the second time week, no, I want you to write down why. And I want you to tell me the story. And I want you to make tell me the true story of your life that made you say this, and I want you to make me cry. So I got to working on it, and
wow.
I just couldn't do it. I went down some places I had never been in a long time. I thought, I'm going to have to quit. I'm not going to be able to get through this without professional help. So, you know, and I wasn't expecting that. I really, really wasn't. And my husband, he kept thinking I was mad at him. You know, I was upset. I go, no, I just can't write this thing. I can't do it. I can't bring all this stuff back up. So,
yeah,
and I'm thinking that was just me. I ended up dropping out. It was a 4-week class, but I dropped out. And I'm thinking, okay, you've gone through 10 years of remembering all this and reliving to write it for each character. And then you don't just write it and rewrite and edit. You got to edit and line edit so you're over and over mm-hmm. again.
Yeah.
I hope you had a support system.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I've always had a really good, you know, just my family, you know, my critique group, so folks who, and I think it's important to have people, you know, when you make a decision to take something that any piece of art, but you're writing something, you decide you're going to put it out there for the world, you have to have people who will help you have some detachment from it, because otherwise you're not going to make it. Like it's a very, you know, it becomes overwhelming. So I think folks who can help, you know, with that, with the writing process, and just, you know, just with the, you know, with the, you know, the endurance, I think, of it as well. But I think it's important for people to know it's not a memoir. It is fiction. So in as much as it maps to many, you know, many real life experiences, it remains that. So, you know, there is that degree of separation for me from the story as well.
Was there anything that you ended up taking out? That, I mean, I'm sure there were a lot of editing things you took in and out, but is there anything that you thought mm-hmm. would just be too much for people to deal with?
Yeah, there certainly were a couple. There were some elements to it. I mean, I think there's, you know, there's nothing that I think radically changed the arc of the story. But I think, you know, just there were a couple of scenes that were like, this is just, you know, we're in a dark place and there's no lights on if I put this in here. So, you know. So there was some of that, and obviously there's considerations of the length of the story as well, and the flow. So there wasn't too much of that, but there were a couple pieces that I removed, but nothing that I think really changed the way you would see a character or understand that character's development.
When people have read the book to do reviews or blurbs, wait just a minute, I do have a caller right here. Hold with me just a moment, Colleen.
Sure.
Hi, welcome to Madame Perry Salon. Come on in and say hello.
Hi, surprise. Hello, how are you doing?
Hey, good, how are you? This is one of our favorite regulars.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Yes, this might be Colleen's first time in a genie bottle. So
yeah,
I want to make
yeah,
sure she's
is.
Comfortable. I want to make sure she's got a good cushion to sit on. I'm going to make sure she's comfortable. So this is our friend, Peter, the Polish animator. Cartoonist.
No,
I'm sorry. He always says, this is Peter, this is your favorite Polish
yes.
cartoonist and animator.
Yeah. Hey, we gotta boost ourselves somehow, so there you go.
We do, each and every one.
Well, I was calling in because I have kind of it's more of a question of art for you than anything else. So it's three generations of women in South Africa. One of the biggest problems that I find as a writer, whatever I'm writing, is trying to not only find the voice of my characters, but try to get my voice in there because I'm ultimately moving a story forward. How were you able to balance the three different voices that you have there and your own voice trying to move the narrative along?
Right, so I think, so in terms of my own voice, you know, I decided my natural inclination is to write across multiple points of view, so that, you know, I used action and plot to kind of be that propulsion, you know, moving things forward and then kind of, you know, giving everyone their sort of moment in the sun to sort of say their piece. But I think for me as a writer, it's really important to, it sounds like I'm possessed, but to sort of hear these characters and hear what they sound like. So probably a large part of the time spent writing, and in the early drafts was actually writing in, you know, in their language. So Ulster is Afrikaans, so I wrote her pieces, you know, her dialogue in Afrikaans so that I could hear her. And that probably took a long, long time of just, you know, defining what their cadence was like, what they would say, how they would react, their speech. And, you know, to your point, understanding that across, you know, not just generations, but also, you know, just which parts of South Africa they're from and class considerations, what would they sound like? And again, what would their behavior be? So there's a certain, for me, there's a certain amount of, you know, just, you know, setting aside, you know, I think your voice as an author comes through in other ways, your prose, your use of language, of word choices and those things. But it's almost like setting, you know, setting the table for these characters to come to, and they can sort of sit down and present, you know, the way that they sound and the way that they think. And of course, you know, you're kind of orchestrating where it's going. But that it was literally just a process, literally of sort of hearing them, listening, you know, writing and rewriting. Until I'm like, okay, this is, you know, this person would say this, do this, and, you know, then kind of mapping that out on the arc.
I don't know if you ever heard of it. There was an American comic strip called The Boondocks. It was by Aaron Magruder, who was a Chicago native. Have you ever heard of it?
Yeah. You know, vaguely, but I couldn't tell you, like, right now exactly what it was about.
Okay. It was about this black family that moves into a white suburb and basically
right.
dealing with the culture shock between not only them being in this environment, but everybody getting used to them. And the family
mm-hmm.
unit consisted of the grandpa, and then you had Huey, and then you had Riley. And the three of them, basically, each was kind of a viewpoint, a distinct viewpoint of any particular issue. Grandpa was the segregationist
right.
who had dealt with the civil rights movement in the U.S. Huey was the revolutionary
right.
and the radical still trying to make change, and Riley was the thug
mm-hmm.
who embraced gangster culture. And the stories mm. basically threw the three of them in there playing off each other and how they reacted to things. And it was an interesting mix. And it's like
right.
it's something that I think people should do more often, because you get to explore a lot more. And, you know, it's like, you know, reading the description of your book, it's like this sounds a little like that, where you have one situation, everybody reacts to it differently, and you get to shine a spotlight on the different aspects using them.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, that sounds interesting. I think that it's always worth remembering that, you know, that even, like, you know, I'm South African, you know, I'm Canadian, so I sort of look at the African-American experience, and even, you know, for me, I'm aware that in different regions, you know, people have different histories, different ways of speaking, different ways of being. So there's always, like, for me, context, and that super local context is everything, even when it comes to, you know, to that, you know, that scenario you've just described, because people are not, you know, are not the same. And that kind of multidimensionality, I think, is important to bring to your characters, because that makes them real people. They exist, you know, on these different planes, their mothers and, you know, divorcees or whatever the situation might be at the same time, and artists, you know. So that it's always interesting to kind of learn more beyond just what they think to who they are.
That's interesting. I know you had one more question, Peter.
Actually, I think I might have forgotten it. I had one in mind, but...
Okay.
Unfortunately, this is how the mind works. It's like you get on one tangent, and all of a sudden, it's like, hit the back button on the browser. No, page block.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay.
Okay. I guess I was thinking about when you said Aaron Magruder, because I used to read Boondocks too, and I think he's a great cartoonist and great writer. But I remember there was a, it could have been 15 years ago. It had to have been. I think it was during the second Bush presidency, Bush the Younger. And there was an award show that Aaron Magruder got an award. When he got up, I remember he said something to the effect, and I was trying to find the actual quote here, but I couldn't. But it's something to the effect of, after he accepted the award, before he left the stage, left the podium, he said something about what kind of sense of humor or twisted sense of humor did somebody have to put me in the same row with Condoleezza Rice? Because they had totally different political views.
Well, not only that, but also towards the end of the strip's run, Huey and the other kids were trying to set up Condoleezza Rice, figuring that she needed to go on a date to calm her down. So, yeah, if that happened after those trips ran, yeah, that was an interesting.
Yeah, to hear that conversation.
Yeah, because after that, he also said, and Magruder also said, look, I don't want anybody, it's just a joke, I don't want anybody to get mad. I'm fully aware that, excuse me, here's his quote, actually the quote is, I was eminently aware when I met Condi that she could make my whole family disappear. Okay, all righty. So, but anyway.
Having characters that bounce off each other is a lost art. There's so many people, when they write, they just write things happening around the character, and the character's just kind of moving through it and taking the reader along for a ride. I mean, for example, probably one of the best examples would be Star Trek, because, you know, Kirk has to make a decision. He has McCoy arguing the human side and Spock arguing the logical side, and he's trying to weigh the issues and try and figure out what's important. But you don't have that without the characters bouncing off each other and sometimes coming into conflict with each other to come up with their points of view.
Yeah, but that's where it gets interesting, right? When the characters, you sort of let them have at it and see where they go, because they may go where you had not anticipated at all.
I do a comic strip called Stress Puppy, and I think Madam Perry can vouch for the characters going off on their own quite a bit in that.
Oh, yeah. So I love Colleen's example or explanation about bringing different people to the table, the different characters, the voice of talk. I think in your comic strip, they just kind of take off, one to the break room, one to hide out in the company restroom, whatever, while they plot their whatever. I don't know how you sit them at a table to make them talk, but anyway, but I do like that, Colleen. I am so excited about your book, and I'm so proud that I got a chance to read it ahead of time.
Oh, that's great.
And to tell everybody.
Thank you.
I know that you're on Twitter and Instagram, because you and I are connected on both of those places. And
right.
I believe you're on Facebook as well.
Yes, I do have an author page on Facebook as well.
Author page. So I want everybody to know A Conspiracy of Mothers officially out in October. But you can go ahead and get the digital copy now.
Mm-hmm. And of course, okay. Pre-order is open as well. So
pre-order.
Like yep.
You will be so. It's not going to always be easy, but you are going to be so glad you got this book. So glad you read this book, and I'm going to make sure, Colleen, and you know, because you can also check me since we're already connected. But I will be sharing this link to get your book on all of my social media. Peter, our favorite Polish cartoonist, I hope you will as well.
I will do so, yes.
Okay.
I will spread it as far as I can.
You got a pretty wide network. So we'll both be sharing it, and everybody that listens, I'm sure, will as well. I wish you much, much success on this book and the next book and the next book and in all you do. Colleen, thank you so much for being so generous with your time to be on my podcast. And thanks to everyone who's listening. As I said in the beginning, I do hope that this will not be your only time, that you will feel you have a home in the genie bottle and you'll always return.
Thank you. Thanks. It's been a real pleasure to chat with you. Appreciate it.
Good. It's an absolute pleasure. So I'm going to go out now and tell folks, you know, next week you can always go on Madame Perry Salon on Facebook to see who's coming up next, as well as on Blog Talk Radio. And after the show is over, if you don't hear it on Blog Talk Radio, you can always listen to it free downloads on Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Podbean. And I think there's a lot more that are probably actually making money off of this. So whatever podcast app you use, you can listen to this again and again and again. And I thank you so much. all I can think of now is just to go out with my song, Everybody's Got to Swing. Thank you so much, Colleen. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Be good to yourself. Be good to each other. Bye-bye.